Upwork is the world's largest remote talent platform. Devs, designers, writers, strategists, you name it. Find, hire, and pay all in one place. Whatever skills your scope demands, Upwork is how. Need to find coders outside your area code? An SEO specialist for 6 weeks? Or a UI designer through December? Pros available short or long term, one time or as often as you need them, and they're proven, rated, and reviewed. When you need in-demand talent on demand, Upwork is how.
This is your tech news briefing for Wednesday, October 21st. I'm Amanda Llewellyn for The Wall Street Journal. As you know, our annual Tech Live conference is going on. All this week, we're bringing you the highlights from our conversations with tech movers and shakers about the industry's biggest headlines and trends. Today, we're going to hear IBM CEO Arvind Krishna in conversation with our global tech editor Jason Dean about how Krishna is reshaping the legacy company. That's coming up in just a bit. But first, we've been waiting for it, and yesterday it dropped. We're talking, of course, about the Justice Department's antitrust lawsuit against Google. The DOJ is alleging that Google is engaging in anti-competitive behavior to preserve its monopoly in search and search advertising. Here's Associate Deputy Attorney General Ryan Shores. He's overseeing the tech investigations at the DOJ.
Google unlawfully maintains these monopolies through a web of exclusionary and interlocking agreements that shut out competitors. For example, Google collectively pays mobile phone manufacturers, carriers, and web browsers billions of dollars each year from its monopoly search advertising revenues to be the preset default search engine. This is by far the most effective way for a search engine to gain users, as most people simply use this default.
Shores also pointed to the fact that Google prohibits other search applications from being preloaded on phones running the company's Android operating system. We asked our legal affairs reporter Brent Kendall to break down Shores' statement. Here's what he said.
What he's basically saying here is, look, in this country, there's nothing wrong with having a monopoly. If you do things better than everybody else, your products are better and people flock to you, that is all well and good. But once you're there and you have a powerful position, what you can't do is then take any competitive steps to prevent anybody else from potentially challenging you. And so that's what they're arguing here. And they say these billions of dollars in payments to preserve Google as default search on you know, a variety of devices and platforms effectively shuts the door to anybody else ever getting into this space and providing any sort of competition to Google. And so that's the basis of what they're arguing here. That Google, it's not illegal to have a monopoly, but what they're doing is taking illegal steps to maintain it.
A spokesperson for Google said the DOJ's lawsuit was, quote, deeply flawed, and that consumers use Google because they choose to, not because they can't find alternatives. The suit represents the most aggressive antitrust case in about 20 years, but it could still take years of legal back and forth before there's an outcome. Brent says it could shake up Silicon Valley either way.
We could end up with this pretty remarkable circumstance because we have this Google suit, and it very well may be that the FTC, as we reported recently, could sue Facebook by the end of the year. And so you would have these two marquee kind of once in a generation cases at the same time in which the federal government was suing, you know, two of our biggest and most important and leading tech companies. And so that could have all sorts of ramifications. I mean, and it could filter and intersect with other parts of this debate. I mean, maybe Facebook and Google win these cases, you know, but it could also be the case that if they win, you have people in Congress say, look, the fact that the government couldn't win these cases shows that the law doesn't work and we need to step in and do different things here.
So that was big news yesterday, but our annual Tech Live conference also made news. One of the big topics we talked about yesterday was the shift towards artificial intelligence and quantum computing in recent years. There's a lot of newer companies getting into the space, and legacy companies have been forced to take note, including IBM. IBM's been trying to improve its prospects by focusing on cloud computing. As part of that effort, the company acquired the open source software company Red Hat last year. More recently, IBM announced that it was spinning off a big part of its older IT infrastructure business. In one of Tuesday's Tech Live sessions, IBM's newly appointed CEO, Arvind Krishna, sat down with our global tech editor, Jason Dean. We'll have their conversation for you after the break.
A payroll and HR company needs to be prepared for whatever is going to happen. You could say that over 70 years of experience helping businesses all over the world run smoothly is good preparation. But for ADP, that's not enough. To make sure millions of people are getting paid on time and in compliance, we're staying on top of each new piece of legislation. So when it comes down to it, ADP isn't just a payroll and HR company. We're the company that helps you navigate the complexities. ADP, HR talent, time, benefits, and payroll, informed by data and designed for people.
I want to start with by talking about the spinoff. You just announced this this month. It's your biggest ever business exit. It's the unit that manages IT infrastructure, about a quarter of your sales and staff. And it's the kind of step that some investors have been urging for a while. Are you done paring down IBM, or should we expect more moves like this?
Great question, Jason. So first of all, just to put the spin in a bit of a context, we did it for two reasons. The first reason is to focus on the hybrid cloud market, which we estimate is a $1 trillion market. And the second is to put both businesses, both IBM and the NewCo, on a sustainable path to growth. And so when we look at the first market, I think that there's a tremendous opportunity in hybrid cloud. And we are confident in our portfolio there and to double down on the business model there. If you look today, we are over a majority, 60% or so is services revenue. After the spin, a majority of our revenue will come from products for IBM. Now, talking about NewCo, NewCo begins...
NewCo is the name of the spinoff company, right?
We don't yet have a name, so I'm calling it NewCo as a placeholder. And just for the audience, NewCo will not be the name of the company. Okay. With 4,600 clients, with 115 countries, servicing 15% of 75% of the global of the Fortune 100, and with a $60 billion backlog, it starts off as a really strong company at twice the scale of its nearest competitor. So we believe both go on growth. And Jason, we talked about mid-single digit growth in 2022 for IBM, and we will be posting progress towards that in 2021. It's not like it's kind of goes nowhere and then you get a point in 22. You should expect that there is going to be milestones along the way.
Okay. I want to probe a little bit on the hybrid cloud thing, because, you know, if you look at other major tech companies, it's fairly easy to say what they are and where they lead. Google is a lot of things, but they're mainly search and advertising, Facebook, social media, Amazon is online retail in the cloud, et cetera. If you boil it down in a sentence or two, what is IBM today? And by that, I mean, what is hybrid cloud? Can you help people out?
Actually, I think that my definition is going to be remarkably simple, but I actually believe all good things should be simple. We believe that enterprise clients and governments will all use multiple public clouds, not a singular. They will use multiple as a service properties, and they will have private cloud and some things on premise based on economics and based on choice. Operating in that environment is what we call hybrid cloud. And so you need an architecture that spans across that environment. And so hybrid cloud is multiple public clouds, private cloud with as a service properties. It's as simple as that. And I think we all intuitively react to, well, that's likely the world of tomorrow. And so that's where we're headed towards.
Are you going to be able to compete effectively in that, given that it's basically a middleman type of role, right? I mean, why wouldn't I as a business just go directly and do my deals with Microsoft and Azure or with AWS?
Based on, is a singular public cloud going to have everything that somebody wants? If that's the reality and they're the be-all and end-all, then maybe what he said makes sense. We believe that may make sense for a minority of enterprises. If you're going to go across it, then you're going to have the question, how do I operate in an architecture that goes across from private to multiple public? And so for some things, you're going to want choice. And so an architecture and the expertise that allows you to operate there with the right security, with the right resilience, with the right flexibility, I don't believe you'll necessarily move on a daily basis, but people don't like lock-in. I think the history of technology has shown that. So the ability to move, but on maybe on a month's or a year's timescale is an important element of the flexibility that enterprises want. And now the question comes, can we have only a single set of development tools, or do you really want half a dozen sets and no ability to mix between them? All that flexibility and the business value you unlock from that environment I'm describing is the reason we believe enterprises will go there. I'm not saying it'll be 100% of all workloads at 100% of enterprises, but likely, let's call it half the workloads across a large set of enterprises.
Let me ask you about Red Hat. That was another big deal you announced, I think, 2 years ago. You paid a big premium. I believe it was 63% for Red Hat, your biggest acquisition. You reported solid numbers in that in your quarterly earnings yesterday. But, you know, that's still a huge number of what you paid. Let's say 3 years out from now, how will we know that that deal was really successful?
Jason, I'll give you some metrics of today. And I think those will point to the metrics that I'll give for 3 years out. So we acquired a company growing in the low teens, about $3.5 billion or so in revenue when you acquired it. We have upped the growth rate. We returned in the higher teens for the last 4 quarters, and we expect to be able to maintain that rate going forward. That's simply a numerical. But to go back to the strategy, we believe that Red Hat is at the heart of IBM's hybrid cloud platform, and you need a technology platform to go succeed. I mentioned architecture previously. I think we'll all agree Linux has become the de facto operating system for the future. So if you begin with Linux and then you say containers and Kubernetes are important, the platform within Red Hat OpenShift, but that's based on Linux, becomes an important element of our hybrid cloud platform. We have tripled the number of clients on that platform. We have doubled the number of large clients on the platform in terms of the large deals that we do. So if I maintain that growth rate, how will we know it's been successful in 3 years? I think that if Red Hat, as opposed to the $3 billion and change, becomes a company that's twice that size, if we look at that is effectively just maintaining the growth rate in the high teens over 4 years from the beginning to that point, and if we make it the leading hybrid cloud technology platform, then we would have succeeded. And I think that people will regard that premium as actually being having underpaid for it looking backwards.
How hard is it to get, IBM's a huge organization, and you're putting this new acquired company kind of at the center of your strategy. How hard is it to get everybody else at the company that existed before Red Hat on board with a strategy that's focused on something that is entirely new?
Well, so a couple of answers there, Jason. So first of all, it's not that hard. I think we have a tremendous amount of pull for it. Our entire software portfolio, the developers in there, have already converted all their software to run on top of Red Hat. So that was an easy pull. If I look at our global business services folks, they have built the largest practice on Red Hat already. So that is pull from them. Now, part of the reason why you see both those teams go there naturally is people tend to go where there is demand from the market, where clients want to go, where clients see the value of being on those platforms and unlocking all of that. Just the natural pull. And by the way, that's also the reason for part of the reason for the spin. More focused companies tend to gravitate towards the platforms. And so you put both those together, and I think it's pretty natural. Because let's remember, a platform means you have the Red Hat at the core, you have the software that rides on top of it, you have the expertise from GBS that helps clients on their journey to hybrid cloud. And so unlocking all that value is what IBM is about.
You mentioned greater focus as an asset. It's a general statement. Do you think it's better to run a much smaller company that's growing faster or a large company that's not?
I've been clear since I came into the role. Growth is essential. Growth is, I think, what the market looks at as the proxy for sustainability. And so when you look at growth, growth's critical. I think size is not. Let's remember, you're saying smaller. Well, we'll be a $60 billion company. You tell me whether that's small or large by most measures. And so I think that that's not exactly small. So it wasn't a question of small or large. It was a question of which piece parts have the most synergy, which piece parts lead to an integrated business model. You ask the question of where this pull, do you have to force people or are they pulling? And so it's all those reasons that led to the decision on what to spin out and what to keep.
Talking about size, IBM is one of the most storied companies in the tech industry, more than 100 years old. You have, I think, 350,000 employees or so now, $77 billion in existing revenue before the spin. Snowflake, another company that helps manage the cloud transitions, about 8 years old, had about $265 million in revenue last year. They're growing pretty quickly, but a lot smaller, suffice it to say. It now has more than half of IBM's market cap. So you're clearly in an exciting space, but investors haven't been so excited about IBM for a while. How can you change that?
Well, so it all points to having increasing relevance for clients. And that is measured, I think, by the market, since you mentioned market caps, in terms of growth. I think growth is what will get investors more excited about us. which is why we pointed to that we are going to deliver mid-single-digit growth in the medium term. I've always said that doesn't mean our aspirations stop there, but that's where it's prudent to go from where we have been to be able to go ahead and make that commitment. Now, that doesn't mean that comes about all by itself in 2 years. As I said before, we will have milestones to post along the way. We fully expect improving growth from this year by the middle of next year in 2021 en route to that mid-single digit growth. We believe that that mid-single digit growth is going to get investors much more excited about the stock and be much more willing than to reward us. But look, my job is to help manage the business. My team will go manage the business and deliver these numbers. And then investors will vote in terms of where they take the stock.
Fair enough. On a similar note, Arvind, what about talent? The battle is intense for smart engineers and other talent in the cloud and AI sectors. What are you doing to persuade younger potential recruits that IBM is the place to go and not one of the companies that's, you know, frankly, perceived as more of a leader in those areas?
First, let me admit, we always have to be paranoid about talent. Talent is what drives innovation. And innovation is the lifeblood of any company like ours. So its purpose, and it's also the ability to solve really hard problems that change the world. When I talk about purpose, I think the ethical stance we have taken on areas like social justice and facial recognition certainly attract a lot of attention. It makes our job a lot easier to recruit and keep talent. An example of that I'll point out is in our quantum computing program. I think many of us are super excited about quantum computing and what it can do to solve problems for which there is no answer today. And that's a wonderful team that we have. And being able to keep that team, then they can attract others like themselves. So we have a team. We recently put out a roadmap that we'll put out 1,000-qubit quantum computer by 2023. We have 22 systems that are alive and operational, real systems, not simulators, not just software, but real quantum computers. I think that's an example where we can point to that we're able to keep the team, retain the team, but it's not just because of what they do there. That's really hard work, but also because I see the ethics of what we do in other places, which we have a hard commitment to apply across artificial intelligence, across cloud, across regulatory frameworks, and across quantum in other areas.
All right. Thank you very much, Arvind. We'll have to leave it there. Really appreciate your time.
We'll have more highlights from Tech Live in this feed all week, so come back tomorrow for more. There's also one more day to tune in for all the conversations, plus masterclasses and networking opportunities. You can head over to techlive.wsj.com/register now. We'll also have live streams and other coverage on our website, wsj.com, and on social. We're at WSJ. All right, that's it for today's tech news briefing. I'm Amanda Llewellyn for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.